Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Cities, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Dagena Dor, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Roxanne Prasniak about her new book, Sudden Appearances, The Mongol Turn in Commerce, Belief, and Art, published by the University of Hawaii Press in 2019. Dr. Prasniak, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dagena. Very happy to be here.
Thank you. I wonder if you began the interview by saying a few words about yourself and how you became interested in transcultural studies of China and Eurasia, and specifically in the Mongol Empire.
Sure. I think I've always carried a kind of transcultural sensibility and curiosity about just about how things work. My family was Eastern European, Slovakian, which is sort of central and marginal at the same time. I grew up in kind of an ambiguous social class, lower social, not neither lower nor middle, but again, ambiguous. I also grew up in a neighborhood in Chicago, which was incredibly diverse. It was an immigrant neighborhood. And I think, you know, from that point forward, I just carried this understanding of a world that was so diverse, economically, ethnically, and not only diverse, but very complex. And of course, that didn't all register as a seven-year-old, but somehow it was very formative for me. So that when I was writing this book on the Mongol era, it took me a good 8-9 years, and I often sat and wondered what it was that was sustaining me through it. Because I had, you know, just a tremendous energy to return whenever I could from classes or raising my son to sit down and do the next bit of this. And it really was quite substantial. So I think, I think that's a big part of my motivation. Yeah, I guess I could say something about the transition to the book itself. I was always interested in comparative history as well. And so because I trained in Chinese history for my doctorate, comparative history initially usually meant looking at the Chinese side of the cultural historical legacy and setting that alongside of, you know, what I knew of European developments. And after I finished my second book on rural China, I was looking for a topic, and I realized that I really had this kind of two ends of the continent and didn't know very much about the middle. And it seemed the middle was not only a kind of a blank spot in our educational curriculum, but something that was seen as just sort of a bridge through or a passageway. And these just didn't ring right for me. So I decided that I wanted to look at the whole of this continent. And that's what led me back to the Mongol Empire, because it gave me a starting point from my training in Chinese history, so my familiarity with Europe and the Mongol era was all about that whole continent. So it was, and I knew that it was going to take a lot of retooling on my part, which is one reason that it took so long to do this work. It took retooling in terms of some languages. It took retooling in terms of fields, because I decided to do this study through art and art history, which, again, I had some training in, but it was, I had to really step that up a lot. And then, of course, the whole history of this Central Asian region was something else that I needed to do. All of which I'm not certain would have happened if I hadn't met Professor Thomas Olson, who is, you know, he died last year, one of the premier scholars in these studies of transcultural history and the Mongol Empire in particular. So he kind of took me under his wing, and for years we had conversations that, you know, in terms of what I should be reading and what sources I should be looking at. Conferences and other things helped, but it was really quite a huge project that I stepped into. And again, what sustained me and kept me going through it all is partly a mystery to me. It was fascinating. I think the complexity, the curiosity about how things worked was just endless.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it's definitely true that the center part, right, Central Eurasia and Central Asia, there hasn't been a lot of scholarship on it. So thank you for, you know, contributing to this field. And can you maybe tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book?
I was looking for another project. I knew I wanted to do something with art. I'd always sort of been a little bit of an art historian in my teaching. And after I was in between projects, really, and spending a lot of time in Italy and Siena, where I also did some teaching. And as I had mentioned to you earlier, I was actually supposed to be at this time this year. And I came across a mural, a painting, a fresco by Ambrogio Lorenzetti called The Martyrdom of the Franciscans. This was really a fascinating image. It's basically his representation of a court scene out in Mongolia, around the town of Amalik. And he created this partly out of what he knew, partly out of his imagination. And because I had done my work mostly from the Chinese perspective, I started immediately to think about, wow, you know, what are the contexts around this art? Within Italian art history, it had a narrative, but I started becoming very curious about what if you put it in its larger context of what was going on literally across the whole continent? You know, how far would that go? What kind of perspective would that add to what we already know about this piece, what we already know about that period in Italian art history? So I took it from there and said, not only is this piece of art at this time produced in this larger context of the Mongol Empire, but anything else was at the period time was also, had that recontextualization issue that I thought I was very curious about and that I thought would be a very productive line of inquiry. It wasn't intended to, you know, challenge or anything the art historians who have other questions that they raise about their work, but it was intended to add to that discussion. And I'm really pleased that I think when I started out, I was most concerned about art historians and, the kind of suspicions, rightly so sometimes, that they have about historians who take art and don't treat it as art, but, treat it as a historical artifact. And I was very aware of that and very attentive to trying to do both, which again added to the complexity, but it was my goal. And I was very pleased that one of my first times I was asked to talk about this book was out of the art history department at Rice University. So I guess some of it worked at least.
Thank you. It's definitely a really interesting kind of approach, looking from arts and art objects at these transcultural exchanges, right? Let's maybe start our discussions right into the books itself by discussing the title. So Sudden Appearances is the title, and the book mainly focuses on the 13th century, so starting with the military expansions of the Mongols in 1206 and closing with the fall of the Great Yuan Empire in 1368. So what were these sudden appearances that your book refers to that took place during this period?
Okay. Sudden appearances, again, in a lot of the art history literature, whether you're looking at Iranian art or Italian art, the art of the Yuan period, you have art historians who will note a change either in subject matter, style, materials, motifs. And I noticed in a lot of this literature that the explanation was just let go of it was a sudden appearance. And again, as historian, my question was, how did that happen? What was it connected to in terms of the political environment, the social environment, the awareness of the world, the awareness of artistic creations that were coming into these regions through a period of transcultural change, a lot of it through the economic and diplomatic networks at the time as well. So tracing some of that in terms of the sudden appearances. And then, again, I think it can't be underestimated that the major first appearance here is the first global era, where under the Mongol Empire, the entire continent is very suddenly in contact. This was entirely new. You'd had regions in Central and East Asia that had a lot of prior contact. They had something more of a common language in terms of diplomacy, commercial exchange, art. But it was for the entire continent to have that kind of integration was a sudden new appearance. I'd have to also say that the second wave of Buddhism that came with the Mongol movement into Central and Western Eurasia is a sudden appearance that we usually forget about because the traces of this are largely gone. And I think it was one of the really standout features that needs some more explanation. And again, this was a second wave, but the first one was 3rd, 5th centuries, and therefore was not a part of immediate memory. And the fact that the Mongols brought Buddhism all the way into eastern Anatolia is quite striking and in a very significant major way. So another sudden appearance.
And then the Mongol turn in the subtitle of the book, What are you kind of referring to here? It seems that you're talking about Mongol interventions in Eurasian history, specifically in terms of commerce, belief, and art. I guess you kind of talked about how during the Mongol Empire era, there was a kind of globalization or interconnecting of the continents together, and also the transmission of Buddhism beyond Asia. But are there other kinds of Mongol intervention that were significant during this period?
Yes, in terms of commerce. And again, I think what I argue is that one of the distinctive features of the Mongol period is that they come to emphasize commerce over other factors, such as religious belief or ethnicity. It's a commercial empire, and it's partly a commercial empire for many reasons, but one is that they're a very small minority, and they had to figure out how to work with a lot of what they were inheriting. They had to figure out how to do it by more or less peaceful means, because otherwise it would undermine their ability to sustain that. So the main intervention is, again, to bring to create an infrastructure, a commercial infrastructure across this entire area, so that individuals that we're more familiar with, perhaps from the European side, like Marco Polo, are traveling across the entire continent. William of Rubric, who sets out early and to try and understand what this Mongol Empire is about, is one of the first Europeans to encounter Buddhism in this era. And he records some of the, some of his observations. He actually notes the chant, Om Mani Padme Hum. And this is, transmitted back in his reports to Louis IX and others. And the others actually include Roger Bacon as well, who is very curious about what's happening out in this region. From their perspective, this incredible shift that's taken place is suddenly, to their east, there is a huge empire across the entire continent that they have never heard of before. They know nothing about. They know nothing about the rulers of this new territory. And it was more than sudden. I mean, it was a bit startling, and I think launched a lot of thinking, reconsideration about some of their own approaches to theology, government, a number of things. At the same time, you have somebody like Robin Sama traveling from the Beijing area all the way into Central Eurasia to Tabriz, and from there actually going on to Rome and Paris, where he meets with some of the nobility and also the churchmen in Paris, and actually I think conducts an Easter service so that they can see how it's done from his perspective. Robin Sama is a Church of the East Christian, so he has a slightly different take on some aspects of that. So, I mean, you suddenly have, I guess to put it simply, you suddenly have the infrastructure, the possibility, the motivation for individuals like William of Rubric to go all the way to one side of the continent, and Robin Sama to come and end up in Rome and Paris for a while. It's really quite amazing in terms of the intervention and the spin-offs from that. And I think one of the shifts is, a reorganization, a commercial reorganization that comes to emphasize that Central Eurasian area. We sometimes cast this in terms of East and West because of writers like Marco Polo. But I think the intervention is actually a reorganization around Central Eurasia, which is really quite significant. In terms of the art, the intervention, It's, again, the movement of artistic conventions from Buddhism across the area into Byzantium, into the artistic traditions that are emerging in the Western Eurasian lands of the Europeans. An intervention in terms of just the sheer number of artistic works that are produced, including a lot of illustrated manuscripts. So across the whole region, illustrated manuscripts become a sudden new focus for artistic production. And because it's a commercializing environment where you have a lot of opportunities and the rise of other additional commercial groups, they have the resources to commission some of these. And so it begins to transform the whole commercial artistic culture as well. It becomes a bit more commercial, and it also it's popularized to a great extent, so that you have new social groups outside of the church and the nobility kind of beginning to acquire and give meaning to these artistic products.
Thank you for laying down that the groundwork for later discussions and contextualizing this. And unlike many other works on the Mongol Empire, right, your book uses an investigation of transcultural arts to understand the significance of the Mongol era developments. We kind of briefly talked about this at the beginning of the podcast interview. So what kind of new questions can be asked with this kind of approach, right, using arts, and what kind of new readings or ideas can be revealed?
I think the main new question is what happens if you take a work of art produced in Siana, produced in Tabriz, in Cairo, and you place it in its larger Eurasian context? What happens if, in addition to what you know about the local artistic conventions and the local political culture, what else do you gain by putting that work in its larger context, which in fact it exists? So in a way, it opens up part of the context that we already know about, but I think it also opens up some additional questions. So I'm not setting it up as you've got local and, you know, beyond local, because obviously the transcultural is also permeating the local. It's not as though there's a divide there. And beyond that, I think the question is, you know, how did local and regional artistic conventions dialogue with what were perceived to be the signifiers of wealth and power? Because basically, with the rise of the Mongol Empire, the Mongols were setting the standard, and whatever the signifiers of wealth and power were, everybody was trying to figure out what their relationship was to it, not to necessarily adopt it wholesale for sure, but to be able to be modern in the sense, to be able to be, to have something in your, you know, your own tradition that was that also indicated your awareness of what was new in terms of status and what individuals, groups were aspiring to. I think when you do that, you get another set of questions. You see that there's an integrative impulse that starts to stand out when you look at that Eurasian context. And the integrative impulse shows up in the way textiles are used or represented, the way pigments are selected and used, access to pigments, styles, motifs, they all kind of, you know, you start to see some of these elements across these different venues, and it raises questions about what's being adopted and what's being selected and why, what's being rejected and why. Again, how are different regions joining what is this kind of transcultural conversation in terms of artistic representation? I think you also get questions about that East-West narrative that I mentioned. And instead, it shifts to a narrative of circulation, an analysis of recontextualization. And so the questions kind of move into that area.
Like you said, images and arts objects can definitely tell us more nuanced stories, right? In addition to text. And centering on Tabriz, right, as the organizing principle in the mapping of 13th century Eurasian arts, your book actually traces a network of cultural and commercial exchanges that involved seven other centers spanning the Eurasian continent, including Tabriz. So in addition to Tabriz, you also included places like Constantinople, Siena, Dadu, which is the new capital of the Yuan Ulus and the political center of the Mongol Empire, Cairo, Turfan, Aochi, and Quanzhou in southern China. So how were these locations chosen for your research project?
Well, I knew that Tabriz would be the center and that would be one of the major shifts that I was suggesting with this work. And Tabriz stood out for many reasons. And I think if I had to pinpoint one, it was the fact that first world history is written during this time in Tabriz. And it's written out of the workshop of Rashid Adin, and it's an illustrated manuscript. So in other words, Rashid Adin had access to materials that allowed him to write a world history. It allowed him access to artists. They were in Tabriz. They were attracted to Tabriz. Many of them came from the religious orders. We don't know a great deal about specific individuals at all. But the fact of this illustrated world history and the fact that it was produced in Tabriz and not, for example, in Dadu, which is definitely the political center of the empire, suggested to me that the cultural and commercial transfer through Tabriz was definitely a core that was worth looking at. So I built the selection around Tabriz, and some of the themes that I had begun to see at that point. So I needed some coverage that gave basically the selection was where are things happening, where the art is both innovative, showing these little signs of sudden appearances in various ways, and at the same time, integrative, where you see an effort to, develop some common themes as well as just the materiality and the stylistic elements of the art. Siena and Cairo are both outliers in terms of the empire. Neither one of them is never incorporated into the empire. They exist outside, Siena being a case of an effort to find some kind of positive relationship, both artistically, religiously, and commercially, all three. Cairo remains outside and more hostile, but in relationship to Tabriz. There's the issue of competition over, you know, who will be the next major center to speak for Islam after the fall of Baghdad. Constantinople and the dwindling Byzantine Empire had a very clear relationship, political, artistic, intellectual, to Tabriz. Turfan and Alchi are both mostly in connection with the Buddhist trajectory. Both of them, again, have clear ties back to Tabriz. Alchi in Ladakh is a territory that is something of a protectorate early on, and where they're continuing religious and commercial ties, landholding ties. Turfan, the Uyghur population from Turfan plays an incredibly huge role in both the transmission of Buddhism. Of course, there's earlier connections in the transmission of Buddhism between the Alchi Ladakh area and Turfan. So I had to weave, you know, I had to pick places that were central at the time in the 13th century in terms of the relationship to what was going on in Tabriz and the Mongol Empire, and also areas where there was artwork that showed this kind of innovative approach, integrative approach, historical approach as well. Dadu, of course, the political center of the Mongol Empire. But then this is very interesting because, you know, the Mongol Empire in East Asia under the Da Yuan was not consolidated for almost a good two decades after Tabriz is designated the capital of the Ilkhanate by the first Ilhan Hulegu. So in a way, you know, even and the struggle to capture and govern that territory just went on for a very long time. Xuanzhou, I needed a place that would represent the sea connections back to Tabriz, because they were very critical, very important. And again, this is something we don't often think of when we look at just the Mongol Empire, although there's more literature all the time that is filling this out. But initially, it's thought of as a landed empire. And I think one of the things that became very clear was that these connections through Xuanzhou, the transmission routes back into Central Eurasia, and then in both directions to east and west, included a lot of interconnectedness with Xuanzhou. So, you know, there could have perhaps been other places. There could have been more places. 8 was quite a bit to manage, but it did. I think it at least set out the scaffolding to begin to think about some of these questions. And I really do see this whole project is just, you know, an initial effort to put something out there to think about further. And so, yes, other areas, other questions that would come into play by bringing other regions into the picture would be really very, very good to see someone do. Not myself.
Thank you. But I think it's really fascinating how you pick these 8 places. They're kind of unexpected, but I think you make a great case in the book that they're actually key locations, right, in the story that you're telling. So can you maybe tell us a little bit about how these 8 places were interconnected in the 13th century? In what ways were they connected?
Okay, well, they all had diplomatic, commercial and artistic connections. So Siena, for example, there are individuals from Siena working in the court on Tabriz. Again, we don't know a lot about them, but we know enough to verify a few and to know that connection is there and that information information's moving back and forth there. Constantinople, lots of evidence of connection to Tabriz. Scholars from Constantinople sent, maintained in Tabriz by Rashid Adin and others in workshop settings where they're given stipends to stay there as scholars and work. Scholars from Constantinople also down in Merga, south of Tabriz, Merga, the observatory, which was again the premier astronomical observatory of the period, and drew a lot of scholars and attention. From Dadu, particular scholars, Rashid Adin, again, in Tabriz, plays a major role here. He was very interested in everything in the Chinese tradition, philosophy, medicine, agriculture. He brought a lot of specialists, artists from that area in order to work on some of his projects in Tabriz. It also included a medical facility and a huge experimental garden. Turfan, the Uyghur population were specialists. They were specialists in governing. They were specialists who mostly hailed at this point from a Buddhist tradition. So they also brought some of that scholarship. Scholars from the Yalchi, Ladakh, Kashmir area, we know that it was Kashmiri artists and specialists who Ilhan Hulagu first brought to the Tabriz area when he was establishing his early Buddhist complexes. One of the largest of which was at Labna Sagut, just to the northeast of Tabriz, northwest of Tabriz. Which was, again, a magnificent facility with temples and libraries and educational centers. And he drew extensively on Buddhist specialists from monks from Dadu as well as Turfan, but also Kashmir and Alchi. The connection between Tabriz and Chuanzhou is actually also very extensive. A lot of the trade that went down from Tabriz to Basra through the Persian Gulf out into what we would call the Indian Oceans today and around to the area of Chuanzhou in the southern Yuan territories carried tremendous diversity of merchant activity, and with that merchant activity, missionary activity, and with the missionary activity, usually some of the religious artifacts that would include works of art, whether they were paintings of the Madonna and Child or items that were used in church services and so forth. So the integration is really extensive. And looking and keeping Tabriz as the center really organizes it. And again, the organization could be challenged, but it's I see it as kind of a first effort to get a hold of what is an incredible amount of information and complexity and make it thinkable and then refine it beyond that or again adjust it. So that's the way in which I think these places were interconnected in the 13th century.
Thank you for clarifying that. And let's maybe go into some of the fascinating and amazing artworks that you kind of discussed in detail in the book. So in the book, you have observed that the 13th century produced an ascendant materialism and intervisuality that emphasized human agency, right, in these images produced during this period. Can you give us a few example artworks from these eight locations that demonstrate these points?
Sure. So the materialism, intervisuality, and human agency all speak to a new emphasis across this territory on portraiture, for one thing, and on historical awareness. So almost writing, you know, that the art becomes part of the historical thinking. And I guess to just add something here along these lines, one of the interventions, one of the turns that came with this kind of transcontinental infrastructure was a new geographic awareness, where people were suddenly aware of parts of the world that they were really kind of blank slates before. And I think one of the consequences of the Mongol era is that even though the empire eventually fell and other stages of this came after, that never went away. It's like culturally, historically, it was not, we could withdraw from it a bit, or you could try and extend it further. But, the eastern end of the continent would never again be aware, forget that there were these central and western regions. And the same thing for the center and the western part. So that the geographic awareness, I think, is something that I wanted to mention that is a real game changer here as well. And with that geographic rearrangement comes the question of, well, what's our relationship to it? And that's where this new emphasis on history and human agency comes into play, I think. So that in terms of the materialism, because this was a commercial empire and because art was part of the commercial exchange, you also get this situation where some artists begin to try and represent this in their work. And it shows up in a kind of integration of subject matter, themes, materials. So let me just quickly say a couple of things about something like Simona Martini's Annunciation and the way he portrays the cloak of Saint Gabriel. He paints it entirely in a fabric known as najish, which was the premier gold brocade fabric produced by the Mongols out of Mongol workshops for the elite, and it was the top of the top of the line treasured textile. And so Simona Martini is obviously aware of this. In this transcontinental exchange, he's seen some of this material, because when you put a picture of the material next to his actual painting, it's identical. I mean, he's got the pattern, he's got the reflection of light and so forth. So that's some of the material exchange of the period kind of moving into the art. And it was very difficult for him to do that. He had to develop whole new painting techniques in order to get the effect that he wanted. I mean, the human agency here is that you have Gabriel wearing the cloak that one of the Mongol, rulers at court in a very, high official capacity might wear or might give as one of the ultimate gifts to a loyal supporter. And here it's integrated into a religious theme. It comes very much from the contemporary material world. In terms of another painting, if you look at the Birth of Muhammad in Rashida Dean's Jamil Tavarik, or Wang Zhengpeng's Mahaprajapata Cradling the Infant Buddha, you get two examples here where I think the artists were faced with the same problem of how to represent these two scenes of children, very significantly, I think, these two scenes of children in a contemporary world, but to hold the religious context as well. So Rashida Dean's work ends up being borrowing quite heavily from the iconography of Byzantine and Latin Christian scenes that show the birth of Christ. The Mahaprajapati scene is a fusion of Buddhist iconography and Christian Church of the East iconography, all of which, again, are moving through these diplomatic, commercial, missionary networks as well. So it's not as though, in other words, anything created during this period is aware of this phenomenon, this phenomenal development, really, of this powerful, all-powerful empire that at the time seemed it would, nobody foresaw its end at this point, so it was the given reality. And the effort to have a relationship to that, to set up a visual dialogue with that, while not losing your own, your own reference, your own cultural local reference points. So those are three there that speak to that, and I think you can look at almost all of these with that kind of question in mind. The intervisuality, again, a concept that speaks to placing each piece of art in its horizontal local context, and then in its vertical context of the translocal and also the historical.
Yeah, thank you. I think our readers and listeners alike should definitely get a copy of the book, because as these wonderful color plates included, you should really look at these images while listening to our discussion.
Yes, it does make it difficult. Yeah, so I'll try and be quicker in terms of the next question, so that because they really do require the images as well.
Yeah, there's so many clues, right, included in these wonderful images. And sort of continuing on our conversation, under the Mongol Empire, you also know that there was a certain kind of religious inclusiveness, but also with unintended secular overtones, as argued in the book. So what are some of the artworks that convey this kind of idea?
Yeah, again, with this emphasis on portraiture, putting yourself in the picture, whether it's a religious picture, but putting yourself in the religious picture as, as a historical actor, this comes up. I think you see it in the Kora Church. The mosaic that has Maria of the Mongols. Her position in this mosaic is very curious in terms of just purely religious iconography. Again, when you look at it, you'll see that she's a very small figure down in the right-hand corner, but Christ and Mary and the other patron are all focused on her and very clearly. And so you have this religious painting, but it definitely has secular connotations. Her location in the mosaic is based on her political role, her political ties, back to the court in Tabriz, where she lived for two decades as one of the Ilhan's Hatuns. So again, the secular doesn't, it hasn't broken loose, but it is clearly a definable part that you can see in terms of just juxtaposing the typical iconography in which two patrons might be there at the bottom of the mosaic, but not with that kind of attention. And she doesn't have the attention because of, she's become a nun, but she doesn't have the attention because of anything of her role, let's say, in the church, except as this emissary far beyond just the religious connections to her, her continuing diplomatic political ties, associations with Tabriz. In terms of portraiture, if we look at Anagi's, the portraits that are attributed to Anagi, the Tibetan artist, portraits of Kublai Khan and Chabi Khatun, you see Tibetan religious portraiture that is in the employ now, so to speak, of secular Mongol art in a Han Chinese dominated area. So again, it moves out of the religious traditions, but Kublai and Chabi are not religious figures. They are, they're presented as the premier rulers of the Yuan territories here. So it's a kind of, the secular gets accentuated even when it's embedded in, either clearly embedded in religious iconography or associated with traditions such as portraiture in the Tibetan case that, were intended to underline religious lineages and so forth. I think the secular part also shows up in the celebration of knowledge acquired from experience. And you see this, again, you see this in Roger Bacon, you see this in Rashida Dean, you see this in Wang Dayuan, who was a geographer of the Yuan period. They're all very clear that their work is better than what's been received, better than the classical text, because it's based on recently acquired knowledge. And again, that kind of human agency, that kind of contemporary outlook in this new world that the Mongols have reordered and opened up as well. Another secular overtone here is the emphasis on good government that emerges in a period when, the sudden appearance of the Mongols kind of threw open the question of how did they do this? And, why, not only how did they do this, but why weren't we more resistant to it? Or in the case of the European zone, what do we need to be more resistant to it or to overcome it? The whole question of how to govern comes up. Lawrence Eddy's Good Government fresco, also in Siena, is one of the premier examples of this. There's also a mosaic on taxation in the Kara Church in Istanbul today, where the mosaic of Maria is. And the contemplation is the same question. Good government involves some secular, it draws to the secular, it draws to the attention of secular issues, not just the idea that somehow you can rely on religious authority to produce good order. And again, that was more of a new idea back in the Western Eurasian European territories than it was in either Central or East Asia. But I think it's very interesting because it definitely draws attention to how do you govern? Yes, there's the religious component, there's the military component, but governing is something else. And a good government requires, perhaps the thinking is a secular stance, since the Mongols, both at Dadu and Tabriz, were very keen on having court discussions, court debates among religious figures. And this was truly novel if you were coming from Rome, for example, where this wasn't a matter of debate. And yet out of that debate, it allowed a governing, it was selecting what seemed most helpful for good governance. So the question gets put forward in a new way and with some new experience, some new data. This isn't just philosophy. The Mongols have done this. They are governing this remarkable, almost unbelievable empire.
Yeah, that's a really great point. I think a point that you really kind of emphasize throughout the book. And lastly, you mentioned in the book that in addition to a kind of humanism, 13th century Eurasian art also saw an attention to the natural phenomena, right, with representational realism. What kind of themes of nature were portrayed in these art?
Yes, there are a lot of landscape elements. Lorenzetti's Good Government fresco that we just mentioned has a remarkable emphasis on the rural areas and therefore the landscape. And again, that has multiple sources. I'm not claiming that that comes only from this larger examination in the larger context, but I think some additional aspects of realism, some additional aspects of, the secularism in terms of taking spiritual figures, Mary, Joseph, Christ Child, and making them into a family where Mary sits and knits while Jesus plays with the yarn. I mean, these kinds of naturalism in terms of representation of human groups is part. But the landscape elements are also there. And so the question, some more attention to that is raised by this recontextualization. Rashid Adine and his illustrations for the Jamil Tabarik definitely draws on artistic traditions from the East Asian region. There's Armenian miniatures. The representation of clouds, animals, water, natural effects, rain, snow. Again, these are all kind of showing up. They're part of the sudden appearances as well, where it's an effort to capture experience in real time, an effort to make it seem, like it's here and now. It's not abstract. It's not just symbolic iconography. And I think one of the interesting things here, too, that comes from this analysis is that many of the elements, such as the way clouds are represented, the conventions for clouds and other natural wind and so forth, the idea that these in a lot of the art history literature are referred to as simply Chinese. And I think one of the things that this study does is to ask us to, rethink or not think in terms of those categories and see what happens. And one of the things that happens with the landscape elements is that it becomes very apparent that a lot of these motifs and conventions really come much more out of the Buddhist tradition of painting that moves again from Aalchi to Turfan and then east into the northern Chinese speaking areas, but that they're quite different from the Song Dynasty landscape art, which is kind of the premier landscape art that we think of when we think of Chinese landscape elements. And so there's an interesting differentiation and complexity there that I think can be misleading unless we do make that observation. Rethinking some of those categories that are, you know, sort of contemporary geography laid on to the 13th century, when in fact there wasn't an entity called China. There was a dynasty of one or another. There wasn't an entity called India, you know, so forth. Things that are sort of obvious, but they still work their way in to this kind of analysis if you're not careful, because it becomes so much more complex to not use those kind of handy boxes for sorting things.
Well, thank you. This is really interesting. I think this is a great point to maybe stop our discussions on the book, that this point that you made, you know, by looking at the art, by looking at all these different portrayals of human agency and also the natural phenomena, that it's probably wise to overlook a lot of the categories that we're used to using, right? So before we wrap up our podcast discussion today, we have one final question for you. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about your current projects? What are some of the things that you're working on now?
Yes. Well, while I was going through the art for this project, I became very interested in music as a trace element through the same cultural political landscape, in images, in narratives, popular and court music. So my next project is to see if what works when, how that works in terms of trying to identify the way music was part of the transcultural exchange during this period. That, however, has sort of been put on hold during our pandemic because it's difficult to get around and do these things. So in the meantime, I've decided that I'm going to write a novel, and the novel is going to be about Maria of the Mongols. She was one of my favorite characters in this last book, and there was relatively little known about her, but what was known was very, very intriguing. So my sweetheart and I are currently separated because of the pandemic also. He's in southern France, and I'm here in Eugene, Oregon. And we've decided that we're going to co-author this. He's a wonderful storyteller. And for me, it allows me to take one of my historical figures and let her step out of the confines of a historical study, where, as you know, you're always limited in terms of what you can are allowed to imagine by your, you know, limited by your sources. It also allows me to weave together some of the feminine threads that really move through the whole book and that surfaced as I was working. And they're there and they're pretty well developed, but I would like to continue to think those through also. Because in our contemporary situation of this global pandemic that we have, I think, you know, we're all feeling that we missed something, that there's a layer that we haven't been fully cognizant of, and we have little bits and pieces of it. And I think that there might be something to glean in this earlier period, what, you know, is legitimately called the first global era. And Maria moved through all of that. She moved through all of that. And I guess I want to see how that turns out. So I'm curious to we'll see how it goes.
Wow, fascinating. I'm really blown away by this specific art piece too. When I was reading your book, and wow, just learning that you're going to be writing a novel about her, I'm really excited to read it when it comes out.
Well, it's perfect. I mean, because Martin's in southern France, it's like when I'm sleeping, he's awake, and vice versa. So one of us always gets to be working on it, and we just pass it back and forth. And it's become a true, yeah, it's become just wonderful, because otherwise, as you know, this is a really horribly stressful time.
Well, I'm sure our listeners will be looking forward to reading this new work too. And definitely your other project on music. That will be another, I think, really innovative approach to the study of Central Eurasia and also Asia. Well, thank you so much for, you know, taking the time to speak with us today amidst this global pandemic. And we really appreciate your time. And I had a wonderful time reading your book. So thank you.
Thank you, Dagenya, very much. It's been a true pleasure.